Sundanese. With mixed with Latin and early rock and roll.
Back from Indonesia into Accra, here with Andrew Moon on the radio. What did we just hear, Andrew?
That was a recording from the last summer in South Jakarta at a vinyl record archive called Irama Nusantara, which in Bahasa Indonesian means rhythm archipelago. So this is a place where I've really been doing a lot of research over the last 3 years. It's a group of musicians, archivists, radio artists, sound artists that have sort of really collectivized over the last 5-6 years to find a lot of the records and sound recordings, early sound recordings in Indonesia from the 40s, 50s, and 60s.
Yeah. And how did you wind up in Indonesia at first to get this start, or did you head there to start this?
The Irama Nusantara was sort of where the anthropology, the research really started off. I'm from Australia, actually, and prior to moving to New York, I was working in an aid and development role in Southeast Asia, but at the same time in Melbourne, I was also running parties, vinyl record parties with Indonesian friends of mine. And so every few months, they'd return from Jakarta with these new crates of vinyl records from the period after the genocide, after the 60s. And they're just incredible music, funk, psychedelic, disco, lots of different genres, all from Indonesia. And so this got me interested in this story and a little bit less in the sort of development and aid work which I was doing at the time. So I was introduced to the guys at Irama Nusantara, and it sort of started from...
And that's a record store
it's a startup. It's actually a house in South Jakarta. The house itself used to be on a golf course, but it was annexed, and now it's a kind of a very DIY. There's a record label there, a radio studio. A lot of people go through there. Yeah, sort of quite an interesting place. The clip that you heard...
What hole on the golf course is it?
Oh, yeah, right. The golf course is just behind it, actually, so... Yeah, I'm not sure. It's a cool spot. I mean, a place like Jakarta, it's so crazy. It's good to be out there. There's a lot of very chill vibe. So yeah, my research started at this record archive and has since sort of developed into other areas of, I guess, making and listening to sound along the Indonesian archipelago over the last 3 years.
And so it's early recorded Indonesian sound that you're interested in?
So the project that I'm developing, and it's really in its preliminary stages. The field work in anthropology is a sort of funny discipline. We do all this coursework, and then we go off for this longer term period of field work, which happens in the fourth year. So I'm a year away from that. At that time, I'll go away for a year and a half, do some more sustained long term field work, and then come back. So the project is really emerging around practices to make and listen to sound in Indonesia. And for me, this is a way to get to, try and ask different questions around historiography in the region, around ecology and the environment. So there are a few other sites that I'm working with as well. Should I say a little bit about those? Yeah, one is just last summer I was in West Java at this infrasound research station. It's actually a partnership. It's an interesting place. It's a partnership with the French government to develop infrasonic detection in Indonesia. And so I went out there to sort of learn a bit about how's infrasound being used to monitor seismic energy, oceanography, and so forth. But when you were there, it was really quite interesting because the high science idea that it seems on the website, it's really something quite different when you're there. A lot of repair, a lot of ad hocism, a lot of maintenance work that goes into these.
Because you're finding things in formats that don't exist anymore, or?
I arrived to this infrasound research station and the first problem was that ants had eaten through the sensors, so it wasn't actually detecting anything, and I don't think it had been for a little while. It was very much a place of repair, which isn't the sort of image you have in your head of sort of a government-run climatological research center. Yeah, so that was, this is sort of testing out in a way, what research might work.
It's more like tin cups and strings than satellite dishes, is that what you're saying?
I wouldn't be surprised if it was any different in a lot of, in America as well, or in Australia for that matter. Science really has to be maintained. It's not a given. There's always repair.
Not really funded, especially compared to other areas of that government may fund.
No, you're right. Although this place where this infrasonic research station, it's definitely been a strategic site for Indonesia and, not just Indonesia, but also the Japanese occupied Indonesia in the 40s. And I was there with a research pal of mine from University of Michigan, and what we learned was that, the Japanese also manned this station. It's right near the ocean. And there are these Japanese bunkers, so they were called, up there. We're not quite sure what they were used for, but I think it's definitely been a place of navigation. It has a longer history to tell. I wouldn't be surprised if the Dutch were there when...
Isn't there like shipping lanes, like all the ships from India to Japan basically have to pass by through Indonesia and through Australia and Indonesia, that gap?
They do, yes. Yeah. Now, in this case, I'm not sure if the shipping lanes go through the... Yeah, I should really know this, but... Yeah, it's a fascinating part of Java. So that was the second site from last summer.
So I guess the culture kind of probably co-opted many different kinds of different cultures, since so many different occupying forces sort of held.
I think forces is a good way to describe it, because I think we went there to learn about infrasound, and speaking with the French engineer who was sort of managing this partnership with the Indonesian government, he was certainly... We certainly learned a lot from him about the technical aspects of infrasound and infrasound's development as a form of expertise.
Can you explain what infrasound is?
Right. So infrasound is so-called inaudible sound, so sub 20 hertz, inaudible to the human ear.
Some whales can hear?
Yeah.
So 12 to 15, isn't that the whale?
Normal? Well, it depends. There are many...
There's a lonely whale that the 50 kilohertz whale.
52 kilohertz, So, I mean, technically that's what they say, right? Infrasound is sub 20 hertz. You don't hear it.
teenagers do, right?
Right. Yeah. No, you're right. Yeah, yeah. Perhaps you can feel it. But what I was going to say was, you know, learning this sort of technical history on site, when we started to speak to the, not the engineers, but the maintenance folk and the repair folk that were also working there, Indonesians, locals, basically, we heard very different stories about, you know, what this infrasound was detecting, or it was also an opening to talk about different kinds of forces, as you said, or energies on the site. So it's very, a lot of, the Indonesian word is Pontianak, I guess the comparable word would be ghost here. But it was definitely a great way to start some of those conversations with local folk about different kinds of animism or, pretty interesting.
A lot of people thought radio frequencies, you could contact the dead when it was when they first discovered radio frequencies at the turn of, 100 or 150 years ago. The ghost frequency and the ghost sound sort of resonates there.
Yeah. And there's a very, strong history and contemporary animistic faith. So in Java, yeah. So that was good. I think I'll probably go back there and try and persist with this site for a little bit and see what can come of it. The repair and maintenance work was certainly really interesting. And from there, there was the other place.
So are you measuring how the sounds that we can't hear are changing, or what are you trying to study about the infrasound?
So I would say, I think infrasound is an interesting way of thinking about how the environment and landscape is transforming, right? And this can open to different questions about sustainability, ecology, environment, along the archipelago. In 2000 and 2004, there was a big tsunami off the Sumatra coast. So, some of these infrasound as a form of expertise can be really useful if it's developed in the right way to sort of abate some of these risks in the region. Just by nature of trying to correspond with infrasound or learn something from infrasound, think with it, if that makes any sense. This can sort of produce different questions about,
like, the earth maybe producing slightly different frequencies before an earthquake or before some sort of internal volcano or some sort of internal event.
Exactly. Seismic activity, oceanographic activity. I mean, the way it works, any sound detection, but there are these sort of sensors sprawled out under these papaya trees because the research center is up on a hill. It's also a papaya farm. And these sensors are sort of sprawled out. You could think of like a spider web, I guess, sprawled out along the ground. And they did just detect these very minute shifts in air pressure. Yeah.
And are the sensors all like horses and bunny rabbits and wolves and stuff? Because then people have said over the years that animals sort of detect these sort of things slightly before they happen, or like you see strange behavior in animals right before an earthquake or right before a tornado or something.
Totally, yeah. Able to transduce these signals before humans in a way, yeah.
We're trying to replicate that kind of
Totally. And sort of take, what's interesting is that the engineer would say that the sensors are listening to infrasound, but he himself, he doesn't listen to infrasound, so he wouldn't take the sound, the file, and sort of amplified in a way. For him, what's most useful is the sound image and trying to discern from that graphic.
Watching the sound.
Yeah. So different kinds of waves, different kinds of infrasound. For him, it was interesting because, at times it was very noisy. He was always trying to look for a very clean, recording, a clean file. The people that we met there were different kinds of commitments to attention or what mattered and what didn't matter. Yeah.
And what did you learn most about from the experience about sounds that you can't hear?
Well, I mean, it was something that I've been interested in for quite a while. You know, just to try and think beyond the human ear as a way of making knowledge about sound and about a whole range of topics. Not getting stuck on the human ear as the only transducer, right? And I think this was a really good way to correspond with some of that. But certainly just also to think about, you know, science in action in a way, and the kind of maintenance and repair that really goes into that work. Yeah, it was very interesting. You know, at the same time, they had sort of like the Warlock system that you have here. They had an automated climatological research sensors there. At the same time, they had the sort of manual setup. And the manual recordings went to a different province. Is that Warlock we're listening to? So cool.
It is automated, but you can also manipulate it too. So as you were saying that, I was trying to do both.
Yeah, no, it was fascinating. I think the question for me would be, you know, why go to these different sites and why think about? Because on the face of it, it's sort of eclectic, right? A vinyl record archive in Jakarta, or an infrasound research station in West Java. But I think this can sort of help to sort of think about different metaphors or materialities of sound, which, you know, certainly maybe in the West, if we want to call it that, there are, you know, certain dominant representations of the sound, you know, sonic metaphors and materialities. And so trying to work a bit against the grain, a little bit otherwise, to try and come up with different kinds of grammars, really.
Yeah, are you a fan, or do you know the Sublime Frequencies label?
Sublime, I think I do know that, yeah.
They sort of go around the world recording a lot of sounds in places like Indonesia off the radio often.
Yeah.
So sort of ethnography through frequencies. And I think they have a event here in Hudson on Tuesday, too, at the Spy Dog Books and Ale, or sometime this week on their website. But anyway...
Yeah, certainly. I do follow quite a few sort of transmission artists. That's why I'm out here. Do you know Joyce Hinterding?
Yes, yeah. Joyce Hinterding. She's Australian.
David Haynes, yeah. Yeah, that works really curious. No, I find that sort of, you know, I find the methodologies that, you know, transmission artists are using to be very kind of similar in a way to how some anthropologists go about their work. Trying to correspond with something, trying to learn from, you know, for a transmission artist, for a frequency, or just quite similar in a way to how an anthropologist tries to go about their work. Well, some, right? But, yeah, the way I see anthropological work is to try and, you know, learn from and think with different subjects. Yeah, which is very similar to transmission arts.
And so that's what you're doing at the New School now, or you're studying?
Right. Yeah. So it's I moved to New York for graduate school in anthropology at the New School, and that's turned into a PhD.
And we're speaking to Andrew Gold here, and so your PhD is about transmission art in particular, or?
So it's about, it's still preliminary, but I'd say it's about thinking, how to think with sound making and sound listening. And I grew up in Australia, I always, you know, learn a lot about the region in Indonesia. So I've sort of convened on the Indonesian archipelago as a place for doing this research. There's you know, thinking beyond the nation state, there's a lot of quite interesting histories among Australia and Indonesia. A lot of the shortwave broadcasts come from, although I think they're being shut down just recently, you would have heard that.
Australia just shut down its shortwave.
Yeah.
It's a real pity. On the 31st, I think, just last week. Yeah.
Especially for the, you know, the remote Pacific, this really affects these communities. Australia played a big role, actually, I should say, in propaganda and infrastructure, radio infrastructure during the genocide in the late 60s in Indonesia.
How far is Australia away from Indonesia across the water?
Melbourne would be an 8-hour, no less, 6-hour plane ride. Yeah, Sydney, 2 hours less. So, yeah, a lot of the shortwave broadcasts actually came from Shepparton, which is down the very south where I'm from. Same state, at least. Yeah.
And were they Australia sending broadcasts particularly to Indonesia or to the whole Southeast Asia?
Well, recently, the shortwave broadcasts were really focused on Papua New Guinea, Solomon Islands, remote Pacific areas. And, you know, it provided really vital infrastructure for emergency risk awareness.
You can't send FM frequencies nearly that far as shortwave. So
no, and they're not as stable either. So, I mean, also outback Australia, these shortwave broadcasts were used.
And the ABC is saying they're going to replace things with the internet, but
yeah, but
that's spotty in those places.
Yeah.
Or non-existent, I would imagine.
It's non-existent. It's spotty. You know, the way I really think about this is how I think about the politics with Indigenous Australia. It's sort of like a politics of care, in a way. So, you know, this Australia, the state, you know, it's willing to care for Indigenous Australians if you sort of play by the rules of the state, right? So if you want to be an Indigenous Australian, that's fine, but you've got to move into an urban area. You know, you've got to move into within a zone where sort of services can be accessed. And there you can be a citizen and there you can also perform your indigeneity. And, you know, this is a national story. But increasingly, you know, you see this is moving beyond the state, right? Because Australia was providing a service to other regions, other nation states. So this kind of politics of care is really increasing. It's extending out into the sort of region. It's quite unfortunate, but I think in some way Australia is a bit of a metropole in the region. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And how did you get it? What's radio like in Australia?
What's radio like? Have you been reading the news? I saw you guys did that great soundproof.
Oh, right, yeah. Soundproof is
ABC.
No more,
yeah,
right?
No more.
They've cut the radio. Besides the shortwave, they've cut the FM too. Soundproof is like the national radio art and experimental music and interesting sounds show. That was noted worldwide. People were fans across the globe and was part of the latest round of cuts at the Australian Broadcasting Corporation.
Yeah. Yeah, really unfortunate. So,
are we going to be at war with you guys soon?
Well, yeah, you would have. I mean, you would have.
Did that surprise Australians?
I mean, this is how I read it. You know, it surprised Australians. You know, aesthetically, like, oh my God, we're in an argument with Trump. And there's a lot of discussion you read in the news about the aesthetics of this phone conversation, right? And how could he do this to Australia? How could he hang up on this well, ally that's stuck with him for so, stuck with the state?
There's
for so
a theory
long.
In this country that they told him, they were speaking to the leader of Australia who's from the Liberal Party. And
yeah.
So that irked him. He didn't realize the Liberal Party in Australia is actually a conservative party.
Right, right. Yeah, right. That wouldn't surprise me, actually.
It kind of explains the whole thing, doesn't
yeah,
it?
Yeah, yeah. That wouldn't surprise me. But, you know, I think what was really missed in a lot of the media that, and I have to say the Facebook comments that I was reading, is the fact that they're only on the phone together because Australia has, you know, 1,262 asylum seekers incarcerated on islands in the remote Pacific. I mean, that's why they're on the phone in the first place. So who cares if he hung up? I mean, the Prime Minister is on the phone because we have incarcerated refugees on remote islands in the Pacific. And these are children, mothers, fathers, families, and they're locked up. I mean, you know, the UN Convention on Torture came out last year with a report saying that Australia breaches the convention, you know, the conditions in which these children have been locked up on Nauru and Manus.
Is it like Guantanamo Bay's in islands in the Pacific?
Well, from what I know about Guantanamo Bay, I'm not sure I'd make the comparison. You know, the argument from the state is that, you know, what are you talking about? They're not locked up. They can roam free on Nauru. They can do what they want, but it's not that simple.
So they're just kept on an island, not in a cage then?
No, they're not, yeah. Well, I think that it depends. I shouldn't say that. I think Manus Island, the story is different. I think there are more liberties with movement on Nauru, but, I mean, you know, Nauru is a very remote island, and there's not a lot there, and there's a reason why there's not a lot there if you read into the history of Nauru. They've you know, physically sold off a lot of Nauru, mining and so forth. But yeah, so the Trump thing, let's just remind ourselves that they're on the phone in the first place because Australia's incarcerated these folk. Yeah, it's really unfortunate. Mm.
All right. Well, you have other sounds for us today. Why don't you? What other sounds do you have?
Oh, right.
To,
yeah. So, well,
we'll keep talking with Andrew Moon forever here. but let's. What do you have sound wise?
Yeah. Well, going back to this research project I was describing with the, I guess I mentioned the vinyl record archive and then the infrasound research station in West Java. And the third place where I did some research last summer was also with my research pal, Cindy Lynn, shout out. Do you do shout outs at Waveform?
Sure, on the radio, we all. Any radio station worth anything should be doing shout outs.
Totally. So, Cindy and I were up at in Kalimantan, which is an island in the. It's an island in the north of Indonesia. We spent some time with a drone making collective, a DIY drone making collective.
And were they making drone sounds or drone aircraft?
They were making drone aircraft.
Radio controlled with cameras and microphones or with...
Well,
not dropping bombs?
No. Small drones. Actually, they had a couple of... I saw a Phantom going around here just a moment ago. So they had a Phantom, a couple of Phantoms. But also they make their own drones as well. They're a research and advocacy collective. And I guess the reason for their work is for their collectivization is to come together and try and work out ways to make better maps or provide the technical capacity to groups in Kalimantan whose landscape is perhaps under threat from plantation owners, corporate oil palm companies, to map their land. You know, the mapping in Indonesia, it's not the most transparent enterprise. So,
yeah, here in Hudson, over across the river, there's a construction road right along the river, Hudson River, that is constantly in the news, controversially, for different company trying to do more, use it more. But the drones taking pictures of these things, so you can document the actual use of the road or what's been cut tree-wise or things like that is what you're talking about. And it's
totally.
Not just in Indonesia or Australia, but everywhere.
It's everywhere. I mean, Indonesia is in some sense a special case. But yeah, it's everywhere. And I mean, one of the problems, I think, is that it's not that there are not any maps, it's that there are so many competing maps. There are so many competing claims on territory, right? So... you know, I heard from one of the researchers we were working with there at this drone collective that some of the maps that have been put out, I mean, the actual, when you put them together, the aggregate of some of these maps, there's more map than there is land. So there's an excess of... So,
and with global warming, of course, there's going to be less land than there is map soon.
Yeah, this is true, especially for this region, remote Pacific as well, yeah. And so, you know, it was very interesting spending time with this, and we can play some sound from them in a moment, but it was super interesting to work with this collective over the summer, because what they're trying to do is teach others the capacity to use drones, right, to map. Now, what they're not doing is teaching these groups how they should map, and the key word here is should. Like, you should map. A map is this. You know, because there are certain assumptions that go into what is and isn't a map, you know, what boundaries one should keep.
There are maps and alternative maps.
Yeah, exactly. Said simply. So their goal is to really educate and provide a technical capacity to map with these drones, but not to teach, you know, what a map is or how you should map. So some of these maps are coming back and they're, you know, very different, I guess, to what your average, you know, bounded, enclosed map, you know, might be a pathway or it might be a kind of journey or a movement through land. Or so some other bounding, or not even bounding, I don't know, some other pathway or... I mean, the analogue that sticks out is sort of song lines in Australia, which is a way of moving through country, indigenous country. So anyway, one of the recordings I have is a... It's a recording of electromagnetic energy from one of the drones. And the reason why this recording became important and why we took it was because we went with the collective out to West Kalimantan, very West Kalimantan, and we met with a community there who were thinking about, you know, perhaps using the drones, take the training to use the drones to map their region. But they decided that the drones, it wouldn't work because they'd be a real nuisance to the hornbill, which is a very valuable but very endangered bird in the species in the region. Used in sort of traditional Chinese medicine, a lot of prospectors, poachers, and, you know, when they sort of learn about the drone, they heard the drone, they were sure that it would be a nuisance for the hornbill. And so we tested this out and we took a recording of, yeah, this electromagnetic energy, and it's a nuisance for sure. Yeah. And there's a lot of research out at the moment about, you know, electromagnetism affecting migratory patterns of birds and so forth. So, yeah.
They're avoiding where there's phone lines or where there's just clusters of humans. So there's more... I mean, how does... I'm just trying to think of how... What can animals do to avoid electromagnetic EMF waves at this point? Seem inescapable.
Totally. Yeah, totally. Well, some places more than others, right? I mean, up here, it would be a lot quieter, if that's the right metaphor, than it is in New York or...
There's a place in West Virginia in the United States
where the quiet
zone, yeah.
That. Super interesting, right? Yeah.
I have not been there yet. Have you been... You haven't been to the quiet zone?
I haven't, no. I've certainly read a bit about it. I'd like to go.
It seems like Australia should... Australia has expanse to do sort of a quiet zone somewhere in the outback.
Yeah, well, we don't know
it's
a lot.
Unofficially quiet.
We don't know a lot about it, right? Because our good friends in America... I'm speaking in this very nation. Our good friends in America have an agreement that we don't discuss it or learn about it. But Pine Ridge, you know, a lot of surveillance infrastructure is in Australia for sure. Yeah. Yeah, so we better not hang up the phone next time. We never know what will happen. Yeah.
Well, we've got plenty here, too. anyway, you're listening to WGXC 90.7 FM. We're talking to Andrew Moon, an anthropology student studying sounds in Indonesia and on different transmission frequencies. Too, you want to play something now? You're getting...
Oh, yeah, this is a recording of the drone. Yeah.
Thank you.
Listening to Wavefarm Radio and WGXC Acre 90.7 FM, and we're here with Andrew Moon. What was that, Andrew?
That was a recording VM frequencies from a drone in Kalimantan, an island in the north of Indonesia. The receiver that we used is from, you can look them up, Loam, L-O-M. I think that version. It's a DIY open source hardware group, I think, based in Slovenia. But yeah, so that was to sort of test out what these, you know, we heard that the drone would be a nuisance to these birds, and I guess that might be a kind of representation.
I guess there's a little more, or maybe not more. I don't know. I've seen more science about the effect underwater of sound pollution from submarines and things, but it's basically the same sort of thing that you know, driving whales crazy or dolphins crazy with battering of sound, and the same sort of thing can happen to birds or or other above water creatures.
Very much so. I mean, there's a lot of work that I'm sort of seeing now about the ocean becoming a very noisy space. And the same is true for the air as well. So, yeah, I mean, the project, you know, again, to try and think beyond the human ear a little bit about, you know, different kinds of sounding and listening, of making sound. This is another example of perhaps where the project might go.
So now you're just sort of trying to study as many different things as you can, and are coalescing ideas, or where are you at?
Right. So yeah, in America these PhDs go forever, basically. I'm sort of finishing my coursework this semester, and then next year I have a year of writing exams, which are these long form papers. Which are in those papers, that's when I really start to conceptualize the project. The methodologies and so forth. And then the year after that, so what's that? A year and a half from now, that's when I'll go away and do some longer-term field work. But for sure, I mean, it should be eclectic now, and it should sound loose and open-ended and exploratory, because, you know, the last thing I really want now is a set of direct and closed questions. I'm really trying to open up different ways to think and work with sound and listening. You know, at the moment there are these three sites and some other ones. Yeah, I'm sort of hopeful, and I have a good intuition that'll help me get into some of the broader questions that I'm interested in about, you know, historiography, you know, how history should be written today, or you know, sustainability and ecology. Yeah.
I guess sound doesn't seem to feature into history too often. I mean, Krakatoa and I don't know how many other, the shot heard around the world. I don't know how many other examples I've got of sound in history.
Yeah, not so many. you know, that could be, you know, the history of sound reproduction is not so long, but, you know, I think a part of the project will also be to do a kind of anthropology or an ethnography of, you know, different, what should I call it, cultures of listening or histories of listening and sounding and as well. So, you know, one idea, something that I'd really like to do is look at some of the early naturalists, European naturalists, and also Australian anthropologists, evidently, who have explored this region. And maybe they haven't foregrounded it as such, but sound and listening is certainly there in the margins of their work about as a kind of expertise to mark difference, right, and to mark alterity, or to mark value as well, because a lot of that early, you know, a lot of the early naturalists, whether they knew it or not, a lot of their work was building into different regimes of value, right? New species of value, new resources, so forth. So there might be a way of reading some of these histories along or against or with listening and sounding. Yeah. So I'm hoping.
All right. Is there anything else we should be talking about, or you want to play another sound piece?
What have we got? I've got a noise track actually here from a Jakarta-based artist. Central Java, a city called Yogyakarta. Could play one of those.
Sure.
Yeah. So this is an artist. Soda Dosa, and you could actually, the release was on Orb Tapes, which is out, I think it's Pennsylvania, Orb Tapes. So you can look up Bandcamp, Orb Tapes.
It might be on sale this weekend.
Yeah, I think the cassette sold out, but you can definitely download the tracks. You can download the tracks there. But there's a really, really vibrant noise scene in
Jakarta.
In Jakarta, in central Java.
And why do you think that is?
Very strong noise scene. It's a good research question. I think a lot of the people that I know and work with, there's a very vibrant sort of activism around DIY tech production, hardware making, and so forth. And a kind of improvisation in a way. So I think noise artists making noise, you know, I think it really feeds into this aesthetic in a way. But there's a much deeper story I need to tell there about. I'd backtrack a bit there and talk about, I guess it's part of an open source movement in a way. Since the late 90s, there was a change of government in 1998 in Indonesia, and sort of since that period, I'm not saying it's opened up or it's transparent, but things have definitely changed. Kinds of access that weren't there before in the arts. And there's a very strong, I mean, the movement from 1998 is called Reformasi, in a formal sense. But there, since 98 and during the 90s, there's been a lot of collectivization, in Java.
Well, that explains that the environment there is ripe for noise artists with those things in place that you're describing.
Yeah, and I think also the materials and, you know, some of the noise artists that I know, one of the noise artists that I know who I actually spent a little bit of time with last summer, he'd use things like bamboo and a lot of local materials in his instrument production. So it's not just noise, the noise aesthetic as such that I find interesting. It's more the instrument, it's more the building of sort of hardware and the practices to make sound. What else was he using? Kids' toys, bamboo.
And is that, what is the artist that you're going to play? Is what instrumentation is this?
Yeah, good question. I think this is definitely not all in the box, so to speak. I'm not sure what he used on this piece as such, but maybe we can dissect some of it when we play it.
All right. back on WGXC 90.7 FM, or WGXC Acre 90.7 FM, as it is just after the top of the hour, and we're talking to Andrew Moon, a anthropology PhD student at the New School in New York City, who has been talking about sounds that you can't hear and sounds that you are very likely to not hear and sounds that cannot be heard. What was that we just were not hearing?
It was great, right? That yes. was so that was a noise artist, Soda Dosa, in Indonesian artist.
Soda Dosa?
Yeah. And you can find based out of Yogyakarta in Java, central Java, Indonesia. Now, that release was out, came out last year on Orb Tapes. If anyone wants to go and search for it, you can download from their Bandcamp, make a good donation. You know?
Yeah, I think it's, yeah, there's a discount this weekend or a donation
yeah,
this weekend.
Yeah, huge discount if you get on there right
Bandcamp,
now.
Bandcamp this weekend. How did you come across that track?
Through the sort of noise network in Indonesia, so... Sort of been following a few different artists, hardware makers, yeah, noise artists, and so forth. And you know, you can find a lot online as well. I should do another shout out.
Tell us about where people can find out if they heard something this when we've been talking. Where can they find out more information?
Yeah, well, I think if you're interested in sort of noise music from say Southeast Asia or Indonesia. Maybe a good place to start. There's a website. I'll just spell it out. It's syrphe.com.
syrphe.com.
And if you go on there, you'll find a really interesting compilation titled Not Your World Music. And it's a series of noise artists from Southeast Asia. In a way, it speaks for itself. Check it out.
All right. Did you want to tell us about anything else or play anything else?
What have I got? Any more shout outs?
Let me turn up the weather warlock as we're nearing the sunset.
I think we're good. I mean, I've got who knows what the listeners want, but we can end with another one of his tracks.
Sure, why don't we do that? We'll finish out with Andrew Moon and another track by the same artist?
Yeah, same artist, yeah.
Because that last one was very good. What's this one called?
This is called A Place Called Hope by Soda Dosa, out on Orb Tapes.
So go to the Orb Records or Orb Tapes website for more information. All right. So thank you, Andrew Moon, for stopping in today.
Thanks a lot.
All right. Up.
Oh.